And tonight we're into our third hour of our special report on the landing of the Mars Curiosity, a momentous, tremendous event. Richard Hoagland with us, and we'll be joined soon by author and researcher Robert Zubrin on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you still on hold, we'll get to your calls at the half hour, and we'll be doing that next hour as well with David Livingston. Robert Zubrin with us now. Robert's the president of Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Robert has studied and researched in the fields of aerospace energy. He has a PhD in nuclear engineering as well. So he is a doctor. I was right. Robert, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine. In fact, I'm great tonight.
You are very, very happy tonight, aren't you?
Yes. This is a major success, and if it had failed, it would have been a catastrophe. NASA had put all its eggs in one basket on this one, but it has paid off. This is going to be a spectacular mission. This is by far the most powerful and effective Mars probe ever launched.
Robert, you've talked for some time about the need, of course, in your book, The Case for Mars, the plan to settle the Red Planet, why we must. Do you see events like tonight as critical to those steps to do that?
Well, as it panned out, this was because of just how much NASA had bet on this and the fact that the Obama administration had canceled the follow-on missions for 2016 and 2018. If NASA had failed on this, it would be impossible to restore those missions. It would make the space program look like fools. To go and ask them to start a Humans to Mars program, they'd say, you know what, we're going to give you money after you put so much into this mission and blew it. No. But so that would have been the downside. On the other hand, on the upside, this mission could discover life on Mars. It has the equipment to do it. They're not advertising that as its purpose, but it has the equipment to do it. It has a methane sniffer on it, and it has the ability to distinguish between methane that is caused by biological exhalations or those that are created by geologic phenomena. And so if it sniffs out biologic methane, it has found the scent of life on Mars.
That is exciting. Now, Robert, Richard C. Hoagland with us. He's with me all night tonight. Richard, come on in.
Morning, and congratulations.
Well, excellent. To everybody, I think. Americans should be happy tonight.
This should be a really amazing up for all of us. Robert, let me ask you a question. This thing is a metric ton. It required an enormous technological leap forward beyond Spirit and Opportunity, which were, you know, a couple hundred pounds, to actually pull this thing off. How close are we with this technology in terms of conventionally landing a human mission, scaling this approach up on Mars in the next, let's say, decade?
This approach is scalable. Instead of coming in hard and crashing with airbags to soften the blow, which is what Spirit and Opportunity did, they put this thing down like a crate of eggs. literally, they lowered it on a rope onto the ground. And when the rope feels the tension lets up and they feel that it's touched the ground, then they know it's on the ground. It's perfect in that way.
I'm still monitoring the press conference, and there was a number given out a couple of minutes ago. They think they may, Robert, have landed within 100 meters of the center of the ellipse. That's a football field.
That's great. That's incredible landing accuracy. That's also a tremendous improvement in accuracy from previously, where they'd be lucky to land within 20 kilometers of where they were aiming for.
We won't know that yet until maybe the Odyssey Pass, which is in 20 minutes, live for you, Robert. We're going to get our first color picture back from Mars tonight.
Really? Because when I left, all they had gotten was the thumbnails, but those were good enough to show that we had landed successfully.
No, we're going to get health of the spacecraft in 20 minutes. We're going to get a lot of playback of data during the landing. We're going to get, hopefully, that first color picture. We're going to get, the power levels. You know, this thing now is over the hump. Unless they drive it off a cliff, which given how incredibly conservative they're talking about being, they're not going to do. This is the beginning of an unending mission. In fact, they had one of the press people who was on live in Taiwan. There's a live link to Taiwan from the JPL Von Karman Auditorium. And she said on behalf of a 10-year-old viewer, "My viewer wants to know when the kids can get to drive Curiosity on Mars." And the principal scientist, who has no sense of humor
at all, bristled and said, well, there are 400 scientists ahead of her in line. You know, typical NASA arrogance.
And Robert and Richard, the Curiosity now is right in the middle of Gale Crater, isn't it?
Off to one side, the mountain.
But it's in the crater.
Oh, yeah, right? It's definitely well within the walls. We're going to get sunsets, sunrises, clouds, weather, cirrus ice, downslope winds, maybe little dust devils, and we're going to see this all in exquisite human color. For the first time, the cameras are going to give us what we would see with very high res, like 1,600 pixels for one picture across. And that all starts in a day or so when we get the first picture, when they get the mast up. They're now going to switch, by the way, I'm giving you an update, from the auditorium to Curiosity Surface Operations, and I'll keep everybody posted as I monitor this when we get Odyssey back on the link, and we may get some really good, real new data about how our little rover, you know, little, a metric ton, is doing there on Mars this afternoon at about 4 o'clock local time.
Well, Robert Zubrin, was this once a lake bed?
There's a very good chance that it was, that this was once in water. And then there's, you know, a kind of an elevation rise in it that they're after they explore the lake bed, they're going to climb, and they're going to be able to climb up and see sediments from the side, as it were. Let me tell you about this. This thing has got a laser on it that they can shoot at rocks, and it vaporizes the material, and they got a spectroscope to see what the chemical composition is of the things that they blast off of it. So they can evaluate the chemical composition of rocks, you know, at a considerable distance away from it. They just shoot them, and they say, oh, that's made out of copper sulfate. And they shoot another one and say, oh, that's iron oxide, and this kind of thing. It has a microscope on it. Okay, so that if they find something interesting, if you look at it microscopically and perhaps find microfossils, it has, 10 times the power that Spirit or Opportunity had, and it's a nuclear power source. It does not go off at night. It does not go off in the winter. It has a half-life of 88 years, okay? And so, yes, this thing is never going to run out of juice. It could eventually have a malfunctions. You know, you never can tell. You know, dust could get into the mechanisms and things. But this thing can last a very long time. It has 10 times the data rate of Spirit or Opportunity. It has 10 times the number of instruments, including some of the very interesting ones that we've discussed. And this thing, I mean, look, if they sniff out the scent of life on Mars, I think there's going to be tremendous support in this country to send humans there to check it out.
I think you're absolutely right, Robert Zubrin. But if they scent it, Richard, if they get that scent, what kind of a scent will it be? What will they be able to decide?
Well, all right. We know there's methane that comes out periodically during the Martian year. It goes away during, I guess, winter and fall, and it comes back in spring and summer, which obviously is a mimic of life processes here on the planet. As I said in the first hour, methane has a half-life, meaning the period of time in which it goes away, of less than 300 years. So unless there was some constant source of replenishment, all the methane on Mars would be gone to detectability, certainly from Earth, in only, you know, maybe 50, 100 years. And even with a rover on Mars, I think John was saying they've landed on the opposite side of the planet from the potential source of the methane. That doesn't matter because the air currents of Mars blow all around, and so the sensitivity of the instruments in Curiosity are going to be more than adequate to detect the methane. Now, what they're going to look for is this ratio of carbon isotopes. They'll break the methane down. They'll take it inside one of the chemistry labs. They'll heat it up. They'll dissociate it so it breaks down into carbon and hydrogen. They'll vent the hydrogen away. They'll look at the carbon in terms of nuclear isotopes, the heaviness. Which isotope? Is it carbon-12 or is it carbon-13? If it's carbon-13, then the consensus will be, oh, it's abiological, meaning it's some natural processes. If it's carbon-12, then things get really interesting politically, because at that point, one can say legitimately, with scientific backing of all the biological science on this planet, for the last couple hundred years, this is what we would say if we landed on Earth, and we would say we'd have found biology on Earth. So that will kick off a firestorm. of public debate, scientific debate, political debate, and I think that's going to be Obama's October surprise just before the election, and it will put him over the top in basically a 50-50 call by the time we get to election.
It'll be very, very strong for him, I think, at this point. If people remember it, you know, it's still several months away.
Because it's the vision of the country we want to live in. Remember, elections are not about the past. They're about the future. He is captain of the ship, if this goes forward, on a future where the United States is not only number one, it's the first nation to have discovered plausible, credible scientific evidence, if it comes to pass, for life on another planet. It's a winning combination because he can then invoke the entire proven economic history of NASA, where when you invest in NASA, you invest in the country, you make the country richer between 20 and 30 times over merely a decade. So thoughts of deficits and thoughts of a government spending doesn't do anything, it's just a bottomless pit, suddenly are tossed in the ash can because this is the way you make real nations, real civilizations rich and richer in the 21st century.
Dr. Zubrin, you and I have been talking for at least 10 years on this program about various space issues and Mars. Can you think of a time where there's been more excitement about a space program than right now?
I don't think so. You know, there are some that, you know, are in this direction, like the Hubble repair mission.
Yeah.
And the discovery of the Allen Hills meteorite. But I do think this is the top.
I think so, too. And Richard, though you and I have talked about the tragedies of shuttle disasters, this alone in the years you and I have been talking seems to me to be the most exciting.
Well, undoubtedly, because it's exploration again. Remember, the shuttles were around and around and around in low Earth orbit. We're stuck by the shore. This is what the paradigm shift ushered in by the Bush Annunciation, you know, about 8 years ago was supposed to be. We were supposed to be leaving the shore, venturing once again out on the deep ocean beyond Earth moon orbit. And Curiosity tonight is a forerunner of that kind of major exploration to come.
Robert, I want you to speculate, not easy for a scientist and an engineer, but what do you think happened to Mars? If it was like a little Earth, what the heck happened to it?
Well, I think the early Mars was warm and wet, and probably for about a billion years, and that's why I think there's a very good chance that life evolved there originally. But Mars does not have plate tectonics, and so it was warm because it had a thick carbon dioxide atmosphere. Rain goes down through carbon dioxide. CO2 dissolves in water, and then the carbonated water reacts with soil, forms carbonates. Now, that happens on Earth, too. But what happens on Earth is because there's plate tectonics, the carbonates, the carbon dioxide in them gets recycled back into the atmosphere. It's melted out and thrown back into the atmosphere. On Mars, it just got stuck. So the atmosphere thinned out, the planet got colder, and when it got cold enough, then CO2 started freezing out of the atmosphere and absorbing into the soil, sponging in, which it does when on particles when they're cold. And then the atmosphere really thinned out, and you had a kind of a runaway icebox effect. And so Mars has been cold and dry ever since. But the water is still there, and it appears that there is geothermally heated water still in the liquid form underground, and that's where life could be on Mars today.
What kind of life, Richard Hoagland, could be down there?
Well, you could have anything from microbes to, frankly, I find the idea that you could kill off all life when Mars kind of turned into the refrigerator that Bob just described.
Yeah.
I find it improbable because on Earth we find living organisms tenaciously live in every conceivable ecological niche. They're called extremophiles. You find them in superheated pools at Yellowstone.
Yep.
You find them in nuclear reactors.
Down in the ocean bowels.
You know, at the bottom of the Marianas Trench where Cameron just took his little submersible, went down and came back. The idea that you could literally kill off all life on Mars, if it had any time for that those organisms to evolve, to change with the changing environment. So I think we're going to find, once we find out where it's hiding, either an extraordinarily interesting and tough breed of Martian organisms that may be much bigger and more complicated than little microbes, or, as I said with John the last hour, we may find that we've had a Mars that suffered a recent catastrophe where its biosphere was decimated, and what we're seeing in the methane is basically rotting vegetation, like the classic Carboniferous, you know, vision of you know, the creation of oil and coal and hydrocarbon gases. Either way, we win, because we learn such insights into what happens to life, what happens to its tenacity, its ability to evolve and mutate and change, and what happened geologically on Mars that may have brought an early end to a burgeoning story and could also happen here, which is why we have to pay close attention to what Mars could be trying to tell us.
Robert, is it conceivable we could find, with Curiosity, a small bed of water on Gale Crater?
I don't think so, unless it's very saline. Unless it's extremely salty, you can't have liquid water on Mars. But under those conditions, perhaps you could, which is why there's an outside chance of life existing on the Martian surface, because life can exist in very salty water. But I think it's more likely that Curiosity will find fossils on the surface and detect methane coming up from underground. I do agree with Richard that if there was ever life on Mars, it's still there. That is, if there were life evolved on the Martian surface and the surface became hostile, life would simply retreat underground, as much of Earth's early life has. You know, the earliest organisms on the Earth couldn't survive in the presence of oxygen. And so when plants started putting oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, they couldn't live on the surface anymore. So they retreated underground. And they're still there after, you know, over the 2 billion years when they could no longer live on the surface. These anaerobic organisms that can't tolerate oxygen are still living on Earth, but away from the surface. And if the surface of Mars became hostile to life, life would find places where it could survive.
You know, Bob, there's one interesting datum here. If you actually weigh life on Earth by the ton, you know, take elephants and sperm whales and beagles and begonias, to quote Carl Sagan, and you weigh it against the weight, the mass of the microbes underground, the microbes overwhelmingly win. George, most of the life on Earth is not the stuff we can see. It's the microbe stuff we can't see.
We can't see.
That's right. Most of the Earth is underground.
Well, you know, last week I was interviewing a scientist about DNA, and he was telling me that there's enough DNA in the body to go all the way out to Pluto.
If you
just rolled it right out.
Yep.
That's amazing. So there's so many things in this universe that we're just beginning to uncover.
That's why the name of this rover, Curiosity, is so incredibly apt.
I like that name. Is the camera better than what's on Spirit or Opportunity?
Cameras, 17 of them, remember?
17 cameras.
There's a whole range of them, from the engineering cameras, the hazcams and whatever. The cameras on the mast, the stereo and the 1600 pixel, they are better by a factor of maybe 10 than anything we've ever flown before. They'll have real color.
That's great.
And as I said, they've got headlights. Actually, it's an LED flashlight on this thing. What's that for? Bob, got any ideas?
Night driving?
Yeah, but you don't need to drive at night. Why would you possibly want to drive at night? My feeling is, and you may disagree with me, they put this on there so when they get into an enclosed space, remember, they're climbing this huge mountain. Let's assume for a minute that there's limestone.
Hold on for one second, Richard, right there. We're going to come right back and try to find out about this question about why headlights anyway. We're going to get some updates in a moment from Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be continuing to talk with Dr. Robert Zubrin about this incredible rover Curiosity that has landed successfully on Mars. And we'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Richard and Robert Zubrin, before we take calls here, Richard, would you give us updates? What's going on now?
Yeah, we've switched control centers at JPL from the EDL, the Entry and Descent and Landing Control Center, to the Surface Rover Operations Control Center, with a whole bunch of very, very excited and happy and gleaming and, you know, high-fiving people, again, all sitting in front of laptop screens. And we're waiting for the sign from all those folks. They just gave an announcement. The communications officer is supposed to alert the entire room, and through us, the entire country, that Odyssey is making its second pass over the landing site and has successfully contacted, made a call to Curiosity. Curiosity's answered, and we'll get more data. Now, that's a little uncertain as to when, because it's a low pass. Odyssey will be close to the horizon. Remember, we're in a 100-mile-wide crater with huge crater rims. We're sitting on the floor of this 100-mile crater next to a 3-mile-high mountain that could be in the way. So exactly when we get line of sight and we get that data, we don't quite know, but I will break in and let you guys know what we hear when we hear it.
And Robert, let me ask you, it looks like in this animation of the crater that there's a cave right in the middle of it.
Well, that's what I was going to get to before. Because of the headlights, I think what they're planning to do is to go inside this structure, this mountain. Now, remember, in our model, it's an ancient structure. In the natural model, it's a huge, big mountain with sedimentary layers and calcium carbonates, limestone, sulfates, and all that. Either way, if you're going to go in out of sunlight, you can't use solar panels, which, of course, is why Curiosity has a nuclear power source. And two, you wouldn't have natural light available to take any pictures, so you got to have flash, or in this case, they have a very bright LED headlight they're going to be using. And I think this is all a harbinger of things to come. And I'm wondering if Robert gets the same vibes I'm getting.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, actually. But while, you know, I'd be skeptical of the artificial structure, there could be caves. And if so, having lights would certainly help you if you want to go in.
Or it could be a huge shadow, but it sure looks like a little hole to me.
Well, I don't know whether Bob heard the first part with, you know, the last hour we did with John. But, Bob, I was telling him that when Obama sent out their Christmas card in December of last year, if you go to the website and Google Obama Christmas card 2011, you'll see a beautiful scene in the library with unopened presents, two chairs sitting at the table, no Christmas tree, but a poinsettia, fireplace, Beau, the dog in front of the fireplace, and on the blinds on the side of the room, there is the actual symbol in the light, in the Venetian blinds, of the Mars Curiosity logo of the project. I think this was a tell to tell everybody who could pay attention and watch that this is the administration that's going to give one hell of an October surprise before the election. And my question to you is, if they were to announce more than 50-50 chance that Curiosity discovered even microbes, what do you think politically, having dealt with these people for so many years, what do you think that would politically do for NASA, a human program to go to Mars, a jump for science, for education, for industry, for the kinds of things of investment that Jack Webb, John Webb, James Webb was talking about 40, 50 years ago? Would it have the catalytic effect that I've been saying it would have from my perspective?
Do we need more than microbes, Robert?
Well, of course, the more exciting the discovery is, the better. But I agree with Richard that if they discovered microbes or better, or even fossils,
let me interrupt,
I think that it would have an enormous effect.
Hang on. Let me interrupt. It's really weird you say that, because I've now watched all these press briefings. I've been glued to this, getting ready for tonight. Two high-level officials connected with Curiosity have both separately talked about the possibility of Curiosity finding fossils. And I'd think of all this as political, you know, symbols and signals. We're all on the same page on this, and I find it astonishing that official NASA people are with a straight face looking in the camera and saying Curiosity might find fossils.
Well, it's equipped to find fossils.
But
it has microscopes on it that could find microfossils.
Well, we think And George, I can't remember his name right now. Come on, Schulte.
Charles Schulte.
Charles Schulte thinks they've already found fossils. I found the first example with the rover, you know, years ago, posted on Enterprise. But for NASA to officially talk about this, it's what we call in the political game raising expectations. And you don't do that unless maybe you can follow through.
Well, no, I'm not so sure. I agree with you on that. I simply think that at this point, it's no longer a astonishing hypothesis to think that we'll find fossils on Mars. We know Mars was warm and wet. There's no reason to believe that the Earth is the only planet that could evolve life if it had appropriate conditions. Far from it, the Copernican hypothesis is that the Earth is not special. And if you, there's no reason why the laws of science on Mars would be different from the laws of science on the Earth. Okay, that is the unlikely hypothesis, that somehow the Earth is special in this way.
Yeah, but it's been the reigning hypothesis for the last, since the beginning of the space program. Remember, all our Mars discoveries have driven down the expectation.
Well, I just think that there clearly is a gradual evolution of thought on this, and so that increasing numbers of people are thinking that it is not that fantastical hypothesis to think that Mars once had life.
Anyway,
frankly,
to answer your question, George, if they start out with microbes and then they move, as Bob seems to think they could, legitimately to fossils, this blows the doors off the space program in a positive direction. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yes.
All right, let's take some calls here. We've got Jerry in Lilburn, Georgia, waiting until the end of time. Hi, Jerry, go ahead.
It's good to be on again. I'm a Coast Insider. The last time I was on, Giorgio Tsoukalos was on from Ancient Aliens.
Yep,
and
sure
the greatest show on Earth. I just want to say I believe they'll find microbial life and fossils. And I'm just wondering if they find like a piece of an old statue or some kind of fossil, that's, like a fish or some kind of billion-year-old life that evolved in the ocean on Mars. Will they hide it from us? Will they let us see it? And if they see, this thing's got 17 cameras, if one of the cameras catch some kind of like flying saucer or something way off in the distance watching this rover do its thing, will they hide that from us? And then I don't think that the Democrats can get all excited and take credit for this, because remember, they took our space shuttles away and they tried to defund NASA. So there's a lot going on. But how far from Cydonia is this? And will it be able to go to the top of the crater and take pictures like very, very, very far away, very close up? I mean, because if this thing is as good as they say it is, it's bound to find something, you know?
I think the crater's too deep to be able to go up it, up the side of it.
No, George, they're actually planning to climb the central mountain, which is 3 miles high.
How are they going to do that?
Slowly.
I don't think it'll work.
No, believe me, it's easy. You can find slopes. They've got assets in orbit. We've got Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, right, Bob?
That's right. No, this has the capability to climb that hill.
We have excellent mapping. They can climb. They've got nuclear power. They've got 6 bogies, 6 wheels that are huge. They had a comparison tonight where they had one of the Curiosity wheels compared to Spirit and then the Sojourner rover. The Curiosity wheels are bigger, taller than Spirit or Opportunity.
Is this going to climb like with grabbing type hands? Or?
No, it's wheels with cleats.
Yeah,
so you pick the right slope and you can go up anything. And
yeah,
they've got lots of time. Remember, they have nuclear power. They don't have to stop at night, to hunker down. They can do science at night because the instruments are kept warm by the nuclear energy. They can climb during the winter and the summer and the spring and the fall. This is different roving. And this is the best thing next to being there with human beings having their own rovers.
Yeah, it can't climb straight up a cliff, but it can go up a pretty nice slope. And this hill in the center of the crater, there are moderate slope ways to get to the top, and so they do plan to do that eventually. I haven't heard about any plans to try to climb out of the crater, though.
No,
that's not what I've heard either. But if it lasts long enough, you could easily do that, because the crater has all kinds of slopes and avalanches and talus and all that, and you can pick your route because you've got satellite mapping. You've got stereo satellite mapping. You've got all the time. And again, it's the time the nuclear power has bought them, because given the mean time between failure, the MTFB, for the hardware on Opportunity and Spirit, which have lasted 8 years compared to 90 days projected, this thing, which is built really loaded for bear, based on that experience, I really think they could send this thing, George, if they wanted to, ultimately to Cydonia.
Well, maybe. What about Jerry's question, if they spotted a flying saucer going by? Are they going to tell us about that?
Well, that's a political question. again, my data, and Bob's kind of coincides, he thinks it's de rigueur now to talk about fossils and find them. I think it's politically very telling that they're talking about finding fossils publicly before we even landed. I think they will bring us to that precipice if they find them, and that has to be based on data they have from Opportunity and Spirit that they're not telling us about. In other words, you wouldn't go out and say you will, we might find fossils unless you already knew there are fossils on Mars to be found.
Well, I don't know if that's true.
That's why you do science and engineering and politics.
They have not billed the mission as a fossil-finding mission.
No.
And they haven't billed it as a life-finding mission. So it's not like everybody's going around saying, oh, we're going to find fossils. It's just that it's sort of
no,
within the realm of polite and respectable conversation
and
to talk about that possibility now. That's
it's
all.
Like they're giving messages. Politics in Washington is all about talking to communities in crowds. They're giving messages about what to watch for to other people, I believe.
Well, here's the thing. Based on what I know about NASA, number one, if they find something really interesting, they'll blast it to the heavens, okay, just like they did with Allen Hill's meteorite. They will not try to hide it, okay? That's point one. Number two, I actually think that if they do find something really interesting, it will be an embarrassment to this administration because this administration has canceled the follow-up Mars missions.
Yeah, but why do they do that, Bob? That's back to a political assessment. My analysis is that the Obama administration knows already what they're going to find and announce, and it would be pointless to do the mission, you know, in 2016 and 18 with the Europeans, because what's going to happen is there's going to be a groundswell for a human mission to Mars, obviating the need to spend more money that way. You want to put the money into the human being.
I completely disagree. The last thing this administration wants is a human mission to Mars.
We will
program.
See, won't we?
Look, Holdren, the science advisor, is very hostile to the space program, very
that
hostile
then,
to human expansion into
and
space.
And this is now.
And frankly, I believe that the reason why they killed the follow-on Mars missions is because they wanted to kill the follow-on Mars missions. They wanted to kill the Mars program.
I don't agree. This
mission here that we have now is a legacy mission. This mission was created by the Bush administration. It was started in 2004, okay? And, this is not their creation. This is not their mission, but it was way too late to stop it, and so it's going ahead. And, of course, if it succeeds, they'll be happy to take a bow. But, no, these people put themselves on the line. They were attacked in Congress for their incredible actions at killing NASA's most successful program.
We will see.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take another call.
Different projections. And remember, George, science is nothing if it's not prediction. My prediction is the Obama administration is going to use the success of Curiosity up to and including the discovery of really big life forms, i.e. fossils, to stay in the mainstream.
Well, we will find out soon.
A drive for a human Apollo-type mission, which brings Bob Zubrin's expertise right to the front.
The big island in Hawaii. Hey, David, go ahead.
Oh, aloha from Hawaii.
You too.
George, I was just curious if now that they got Curiosity up, they're leaving politics out of this now. I'm just curious as to whether or not that they're ever going to use or had a thought of using Curiosity to discover whether or not...
Oh, my God.
Huh?
I'm seeing a stunning new image from Curiosity a la Odyssey in this next pass.
Oh.
The resolution is breathtaking. The covers are off. And these are lousy black and white
That's why they're clappy. But let's get your question in, Dave, before we have to hit the break. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just wondering if Curiosity was... if they ever took the notion to use Curiosity to find out, if you believe in it, that what part, if any, that Mars may have played in the Big Bang Theory and with maybe life underground and evolving an evolution.
Well, maybe the life underground, but definitely not the Big Bang. I don't think it's going to go there in that direction. Explain this picture you're looking at, Richard.
Well, it's another HazCam shot from low on the back, I think, next to the nuclear power supply. These are hazard cameras, HAZCAMs they're called for short, that allow the engineers to drive this thing by remote control and not run over a cliff. And they have the dust covers on during the first pass, and now they pop the dust covers off, and the second Odyssey pass got the uplink and was able to relay that with the 14-minute speed of light time between Mars and Earth tonight. And they're all smiling. Even this very acerbic, lead scientist who said, 400 scientists are in front of that girl from Taiwan who wants to run the rover. He's smiling because you can see the pebbles. You can see the. Are you in front of a screen, Bob?
No, not right now.
You should be.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture now.
Can you see it?
Yeah, it's great resolution.
And these are lousy pictures. This is nothing compared to what we're ultimately going to see.
Why are they in black and white, though? Where's the color?
Because black and white is easier and quicker to send than color.
Well, we'll get the color later.
You'll get the color maybe on this pass. They're going to turn on the color camera in the arm, the sampler arm, the big robot arm. The microscopic camera in that can take actually long-distance pictures now as opposed to close-up microscopic shots, and that's a color camera, and they were going to give us one shot as early as possible. They may get that today, or it may come in tomorrow night. We may have to wait until about 5:30 tomorrow afternoon, your time, for the first direct link between Curiosity and JPL with the rover's own radio transmitter and high gain antenna.
If there are fish bones there, they'll find it, won't they?
We'll find it. Again, it's political. Robert and I disagree because he thinks it's derogatory to talk about the science. I'm saying, to me, it's a stunning political breakthrough to have mainstream NASA guys talk about it, even if it isn't in the literature. Who cares? It's them on television. Remember Gene Roddenberry's maxim to me years ago, Dick, if it's real, it will be on television. Two guys senior in the project sat on the briefings coming out of JPL today, and both of them separately said, and we might find fossils. That, to me, is a telling clue as to where this thing could be going.
Well, we shall see. Robert Zubrin, my friend, 30 seconds to go. What's new with you?
Well, what's new is we just completed the Mars Society convention here in Pasadena.
Oh, great.
And we saw the landing together, and let me tell you, the people here had a very good night.
Excellent for you. It's been a great night indeed. Robert Zubrin has been our special guest this hour. Up next, David Livingston joins us. We'll be talking about his work and his reaction to all of this, along with Richard C. Hoagland. All the websites linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.